person like yourself. I mean,
thank you, bro.
I've listened to your albums, your EPs, man. Like, it's my hands are up. I can't.
Well, I don't even know. Now that you've given everyone a taste, yeah. Tell us again where the next place you're going to be performing is.
Zoomtopia. Sorry, on October 23rd, 6 to 9.
And that's 810 Southeast Belmont. So hopefully we'll see folks out there. There's an additional benefit for the African Hip Hop Caravan happening at the Portland Playhouse on 6th and Prescott this coming Sunday, the 25th as well, starting at 7:30. And I also just want to squeeze in that the Oregon Arts Commission and the Traditional Arts Apprenticeship Program have granted us a gift that are kind of helping with the cost of the caravan. So.
Well, that wraps it up just about for the week. Backy Coles, Mike Crenshaw, thank you so very much for coming in today. That was really, really outstanding.
Most of, I wanted to ask if I can say just I don't have any recorded music at the moment, but people can find me on SoundCloud if you look up King Narmer, King KingNarmer. I'm on there. I post music that I like. But I have yet to post music from me. It is coming, though. I have a project coming. So
stay tuned.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you again, both.
Thank you, guys. Thank you
so much. We'll see you all next week.
All right.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland. That was the volunteer-produced evening news. Up next is Occupy Radio. We're going to be hearing from It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, Too Big to Exist, Nature Limits All Systems, Nothing Grows Forever, Economic Systems Built Around Growth Like Ours Are No Different. Ellen revisits that topic with biomimicry expert Jamie Brown Hansen about what nature teaches regarding sustainable economic systems that last for eras rather than just decades. Theme is picked up by Bernie Sanders as he reflects on the precarious nature of our national economy. Matt Stannard considers what's not being addressed on the topic by the presidential candidates. And co-host Walt McCree talks with New Hampshire State Representative Valerie Frazier about the movement underway there to create a public state bank. First, we got some words of wisdom for ya. So keep it tuned. KBOO Portland, Occupy Radio up next. But check this out.
Start your Saturday morning with a little swingin' country. The KBOO Swingin' Country program will be broadcasting live from the Tin Shed Garden Cafe on Saturday, October 24th from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. I know you've been hankering to put a face to those velvety tones, so here's your chance. You are welcome to come early, pull up a chair, and enjoy some coffee, food, and an earful of swinging country. The Tin Shed Garden Cafe is located at 1438 Northeast Alberta Street in the City of Roses. Again, that's Swinging Country live from the Tin Shed, Saturday, October 24th, here at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
October is Filipino American History Month to honor the moment in history when the first documented Filipinos on a Spanish galleon arrived in Morro Bay, California in October, 428 years ago. Tune in Friday night, October 23rd from 6 p.m. to midnight as KBOO airs music, interviews, and live programming that give voice to largely untold stories of Filipino Americans who have shaped American culture and the course of history. We'll hear from legends such as Joe Bataan and Fanny, as well as hip-hop artists like Bamboo and Rocky Rivera. That's Friday night, October 23rd, starting 6 p.m. to midnight at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier.
Despite a huge increase in technology and productivity, millions of American workers are working longer hours for low wages, and median family income is almost $5,000 less than it was in 1999. While the middle class continues its 40-year decline, we have 45 million people living in poverty and the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country on earth. Half of the American people have less than $10,000 in savings and have no idea as to how they will retire with dignity. The real unemployment rate today is not 5.5%, but it is close to 11%.
That voice is perhaps unmistakable these days. It's Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont, of course, the surging presidential candidate who recently introduced a bill for breaking up the big banks, with a sobering litany of what has happened to the American economy. A sort of cold water in your face application to get us to think honestly about the facts so that we can take some appropriate action. Hello, I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute, with another edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. We're going to hear a bit more of Bernie Sanders' description later in the program so we can get a bigger picture of our economic reality as we consider how far afield we are from operating a sustainable economic system, the one that has brought humanity so far, up to about 200 years ago, but that may have finally run its evolutionary course. That's not meant to be a scare tactic. It's really just part of the wake-up calls that have been emerging as this planet hurdles toward systemic breakdowns and failures resulting from our own consumptive, unregenerative practices. Ellen's guest today puts that reality in perspective. A repeat visitor to the program, biomimicist Jamie Brown, who will give you new insight into how much we can learn by observing how nature constructs sustainable systems and how obvious the rules are that we could employ to help us change course. Now, because this is a program about our money, we continually observe that the global banking interests are the key players that are accelerating systemic breakdown because of their extractive business model. But we also speak of the very promising new realizations about replacement systems and paradigm shifts that are happening at the grassroots level. One of the exciting indicators is the growing push around the country to create new public banks. And later in the program, we'll hear from a state rep in the New Hampshire legislature who's promoting a bill to establish a state bank there. We'll find out what's driving her statewide campaign. And we'll hear from Matt Standard on the Public Banking Report about the status quo nature of the talk about our economy as demonstrated in the presidential debates, including Bernie Sanders. But now let's catch up with Ellen about some of her views about recent developments in the world of banking, government, and politics.
We started the show today with a clip from Bernie Sanders talking about this real status of the American economy, and it's pretty grim. The things behind the scenes and the conversations that are developing in Washington seem to not be very effective at making any sorts of substantial changes, not structural changes. They're merely distribution changes. How are you seeing the national discussion about the economy at this point in this presidential season?
Well, I totally agree that the big banks are too big. I think that's what Bernie Sanders' bill was about, breaking up the big banks. But he also said that Dodd-Frank had not gone far enough. And I think it has gone too far in the wrong direction. In other words, it was, as somebody said, they wouldn't really know how it worked till they tried it, and it was just an experiment. And it hasn't worked. First of all, of course, they very secretively incorporated bail-ins. The big deal was no more bailouts. This is going to solve the bailout problem. No more will the taxpayers have to pay for when a big bank goes under. But in fact, instead, what the Dodd-Frank Act says is that they have to capitalize themselves by taking their creditors' money, turning their creditors' money into stock, basically. And the largest class of creditor of any bank is their depositors. So they're going to take our money and capitalize themselves with it. And this is law. It's not even like that you could sue them for taking your money. It's like, no, we had to do it. It was in the Dodd-Frank Act. That's what we're supposed to do.
So you're saying that the Dodd-Frank Act actually codified the confiscation of our dollars, of municipal dollars, of personal dollars, of state dollars, for the sake of saving the banks, that is now the law.
Right. And it's not like the old-fashioned bankruptcies, where the idea was that you'd take the assets and dole them out to the creditors according to seniorities, and then the bank would actually close, go bankrupt. Now, it's all about saving the banks. The banks are not to go bankrupt, so it's not a bankruptcy. It's like, how can we save ourselves by stealing our customers' money, basically? Seriously, that's what it says.
That's a fairly nice move on their part. In other words, they can't go out of business, and they'll take our money, and they'll still be in business.
Right. So there's that. But besides that, it heavily regulates the small banks, and it's putting them out of business. Last week when we were in New Hampshire, State Bank Rep Valerie Frazier and I met with a banker, a president of a bank, who was really upset with the new regulations from Dodd-Frank. He was livid. He said that the regulations are still coming down from the Dodd-Frank. They're still writing them, and that they are so difficult for these small banks to comply with. And not even just coming up with the money, but actually having the personnel to comply. I think the application itself is something like 90 pages, and I mean, it's just a huge burden to have to deal with all these regulations, and the regulators are hovering over all the time, and they've limited their ability to make loans, to do what they're best at, which is to make small and medium-sized business loans. And the big banks don't want the small and medium-sized business loans. And in fact, Bank of America has just announced that they are cutting off. They don't want the city's money, not all the cities, but the smaller cities. They're saying, we don't want your business anymore. Take it. You've got 90 days to find another bank, which is really upsetting to these cities. But it's because of increased regulations and increased capital requirements, increased securitization, collateralization. Some states require 110% collateral anyway, so the deposits of the cities don't do them much good. So anyway, it seems to me that the small banks are being overregulated, and meanwhile, the big banks, who have the big lobbyists, have figured out how to escape all the regulations that would have affected them, as we saw last December when they managed to get rid of the last 5%, basically, of derivatives regulation, which we suspected had to do with the oil derivatives since oil had crashed. Anyway, they've got the lobbyists, and they've got the ability to arm twist to suit themselves.
So where does that leave municipalities and smaller municipalities in particular at this moment? If they don't have the ability to do local banking, do you see that public banks would be a logical place or maybe the only resort that they could go to?
I do. That is definitely, I would say, that's the answer on both counts. The cities need a place to put their money, and big banks don't want their money anymore. It's not cost-effective for them. So if they have their own bank, then the problem with the community banks is they're a bit too small to handle public monies. Let's say the money of California, I was told that's not useful for them to put it in small banks because of the collateralization requirement. And because small banks don't have the ability to do international dealings and credit cards, you know, they take credit cards for things like payment of taxes and fees.
Right.
So So they need a big bank, so they might as well set up their own facility. And you could have the one state that does not have all these problems, that has four times as many community banks per capita as other states on average, and more banks per capita than any other state, is North Dakota. And they do wholesale banking. Seems to me you should have a state bank in every state that would partner with the local banks, help them with capitalization, and arguably, they could have an agency, a part of the bank, that deals with regulations for all the community banks. In other words, economies of scale.
Just for our listeners who don't know what collateralization is on the part of municipal or community banks or any banks, when a government deposit is made or municipal deposit is made in an institution, that institution is required by state law to collateralize, to set aside a certain amount of its capital to ensure that the money will be there when the city, county, state wants it. So that means that they can't use that part of their capital to lend out into the marketplace, which is where they make their money. So it's an undesirable situation for small banks in particular, who are restricted in a lot of other ways. But, you know, some have said, and I think you're included in that, is that the big banks have really strategized this as a way of getting rid of the community banks and cutting down on that marketplace. That's really what's kind of going on here, isn't it?
Well, it certainly looks that way, that the big banks are getting bigger. I think they're 80% bigger than they were before 2008, and they're 30% bigger than they were when Dodd-Frank was passed. So they're growing. But then one reason that they're growing, I have read that three of the four banks are growing, the four biggest banks, and those three took over these other failing institutions that were not actually banks, like J.P. Morgan took over Bear Stearns and Washington Mutual. And Wells Fargo took over Wachovia, and Bank of America absorbed Countrywide and Merrill Lynch. And then you had Lehman Brothers, and nobody was willing to take it. But, I mean, that was actually good, theoretically, for the stability of the whole system, that these big banks were there and able to take over those other entities. So they've grown because they've taken on these toxic partners, basically. And the regulators are regulating them as well. I mean, they're not really happy about a good bit of Dodd-Frank as well, because the regulators are also stepping into their business decisions and turning them into a public utility. So it seems to me that ideally they're getting the profits, and their business model is to serve the shareholders and, you know, short-term profits, et cetera, shareholders. And I don't know that the shareholders are doing so well at the big banks, but the CEOs and the executives that are doing really well. Anyway, their mandate is a little different from a government mandate. So it seems to me the obvious thing is, if it's going to be a public utility, just make it a public utility and have its mandate be to serve the public, as you have in some other countries, like the German Sparkasm model. And
well, it seems to me people should be very attuned to this and upset about it, because one of the impacts of having community banks go out of business is that lending to local people and to small businesses disappears. When the community banks go away, where do you get money to fund a new business? You know, you go to your friends, you go to your credit card, or you get into a debt situation that's not very desirable, and it's very expensive. So the big banks, which are not making those loans, are offering them on horrible terms or at very expensive rates in terms of, like, credit cards are, what, 20-30%, depending upon what it is. So this monopoly financial control is really squeezing the life out of our prospects, out of our economy.
Agreed. And the big banks aren't actually capable of, I've read, making loans to small and medium-sized businesses, because they operate based on computerized models. In other words, they look at your credit rating and they'll give you a loan based on that. But it's the local banks that know their customers. They have other ways of determining that this project is likely to be a success, because we know these people and we know their dad was in business and did well, and, you know, we know what's behind the deal. And they actually have a much lower default rate on those loans than the big banks do. So you need somebody out there in the field who knows the customer and whose job is to do personalized determination of creditworthiness.
Your conversation with Jamie this week, I was talking about another example of how unsustainable this consolidation, this monopoly of financial control is. Simply by looking at nature, you see that monocultures and singular organisms are less stable and less adaptive and less resilient, whereas when you have multiple banks, shall we say, and multiple financial agencies and perhaps even types of currency, types of exchange, allows for an economy to be much more robust and resilient and therefore sustainable. So it almost seems like the big banks are driving us out of the economy that we've known and forcing us into alternatives in order to try to make our way.
And it seems to me we have so little power at the federal level, and we do have some power at the state level, the city level. I mean, if only as an interim measure we need to set up our own banks at that level while we work on the national level. I mean, I was actually quite impressed that Hillary Clinton changed her stance on the TPP and is actually against it now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. So things do change, I guess, maybe arguably in Washington.
Well, maybe there's some hope there.
But
and then, of course, we'll hope first, and then we'll see what shows up later on. Well, thanks very much, Ellen. We'll get on with the show, and we'll see what happens next.
Okay. Thank you.
It's my great pleasure to be interviewing my daughter, Jamie Brown, who lives in Switzerland and has just come to the States to speak at a conference in Austin, Texas. It was called the South by Southwest Eco Conference, and she was speaking on how nature would design a financial system. So I thought I'd take this opportunity to interview her again to give an update on how the biomimicry approach has evolved since we heard from her last year. Jamie is a community credit architect and biomimicry specialist in Basel, Switzerland. She is also a managing partner of Biomimicry Switzerland, and she spent the last 2 years studying lessons from the natural world that can help us create a better money system. She's now working with the Biomimicry Global Network to put these lessons into practice. She created and administers a global community credit facility called the Biomimicry Exchange Network, and is focused on raising awareness and understanding of community credit solutions in general. Jamie, great to have you here.
Thanks. It's nice to be back on your show.
So can you tell us a bit about biomimicry? You've done this before, but just a quick summary of what it is and what it might have to do with designing a financial system.
Generally, biomimicry is about learning from nature. So it's the conscious emulation of nature's genius. And it's something that we've been practicing for thousands of years, but a structured modern discipline has grown up around this practice since the publication of Janine Benyus' book called Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature, in 1997. So since then, this has become a branch of science, a new way of doing biology that's more like physics. It's also a design methodology where we translate between biological design and human design, and it's a sustainability framework with the understanding that the only credible vision of a sustainable economy is arguably one that's an extension of ecology, that's consistent with the design of our biological Earth and its ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. So how do you define ecology exactly?
Well, ecology is about the relationships, systemic relationships in the natural world.
You've mentioned that organisms evolve in nature from competition to cooperation when they become higher organisms, which again evolve from competition to cooperation. I thought that was a really cool way of looking at it, and that we're at that stage now in our financial development. So could you give some examples of that and relate it to where we are now in banking and finance?
Sure. This is an idea that's been developed or communicated especially by evolution biologist Elizabeth Sartoris, and she talks about the maturation spiral that all living systems go through. So it isn't only organisms that mature that have a youthful phase and an adult phase. It's also ecosystems go through a maturation process, and cells go through, single-celled organisms go through a maturation process. So every natural system follows a maturation spiral that began 3.8 billion years ago with the formation of bacteria, which were then very competitive with each other for something around a billion years, grew until they focused on expansionary growth until they encompassed the entire planet. They also created the first destabilizing climate change. They created the first global communication system. But at some point, they maxed out their expansionary growth potential. They maxed out that strategy, and they've reached the limits of their growth, and cooperative strategies started to pay off more than competitive strategies. So then they shifted into a mature phase where they started forming cooperatives, which then ultimately evolved into the nucleated cell, which is much larger than a bacteria. It's like a giant cooperative of bacteria. And the nucleated cell then went through its own maturation process. It went through a competitive period where it was focused on youthful growth and expansion, quantitative growth. And then it maxed out that strategy, and cooperative strategies started to give more return. And so they became more cooperative and ultimately evolved into multicellular organisms, which are giant cooperatives among cells. You can think of them that way. And the process goes on and on with organisms that then evolve in communities. We are an example of an organism that evolves in a community. It's called a superorganism, like bees or ants or termites. Those are also superorganisms. And ecosystems also go through their own maturation phases. So we are now at a point where, over the last 5,000 years, the technologies of money and credit and exchange, those are the technologies that facilitated our youthful expansionary phase, where we expanded from small tribes into global empires and now into a single global economic superorganism. And the bank credit system, the dominant model of money that we use now, which is now a single global system, it's globally integrated, globally homogenous, and it's designed from the global level. It was the completion of that expansionary process over the last 300 years. And the reason it completed the process is because its design is premised entirely on quantitative expansion, which is what this youthful phase was all about for the past 5,000 years. But now we've maxed out now it has encompassed the entire globe, and so we have maxed out that strategy, and we're losing returns in the material realm on further efforts at expansion because we're just running out of space in the real world to expand into.
And resources.
Yeah. So now conventional finance is moving into the only realm where quantitative expansion can last forever, which is virtual reality. And that's how we end up with a derivatives trade that's valued at anywhere from 10 to 20 times the GDP of the entire planet, while real-world communities that are back on the ground are left in a monetary vacuum. So that's the situation we're in.
And how would you propose to fill the vacuum?
Well, the vacuum is already being filled, and that's what's so interesting to me, is to watch what's emerging on the ground below the canopy of bank credit. There's a permaculture landscape of community credit systems that are emerging on the ground from the bottom up all over the world. There are now thousands of these community credit systems. And what's the most interesting to me is that they are consistent with biological design principles in all the ways that bank credit is not. They're consistent with the design of mature biological systems, the ones that are regenerative over the long term. So they are bottom-up, locally attuned and adapted to the local context. They're decentralized, they're very diverse, and they're not premised on quantitative expansion. You could say they're premised on qualitative expansion with quantitative stability over time, which is appropriate for the next phase that we're moving into as a species, which is a mature, stable phase. So my interest is to broaden awareness and understanding of the fact that we already have a choice between bank credit and community credit, and we can look for opportunities to gradually shift our weight as the opportunities become more and more available, to gradually shift our weight into community credit systems so that we can then start taking the other foot out of bank credit.
You've pointed out that it's getting easier and easier to do this with the internet and so forth. So how would you suggest that people get involved if they wanted to get involved? And can you report some on the development in combining these different community currency systems?
Sure. At the moment, this is a global landscape of local credits facilities. So it's very easy to offer community credit within a local network of trust. It's a lot harder to offer community credit for something you want to order from China. So the next piece that's being worked on now in the development of the community credit paradigm is software extensions that would enable community credit facilities to intertrade with each other, to communicate with each other, so that even if you are located in a small credit facility in your home community, you can still access credit from a larger credit commons through the agreements among communities. So at the moment, this landscape is, it's very diverse and dynamic. I said there are thousands of them around the world. And you can recognize three cultures that have so far emerged that are recognizable among community credit systems. They are LETS, which stands for Local Exchange Trading Systems, business-to-business barter systems, which is actually a misnomer because it's not really barter, it's credit exchange, but never mind. And then the third one is time banks. So all of these community credit systems, they're organized a little bit differently and they use different platforms, but they're all premised on the same basic principle of mutual credit exchange. So a community credit facility is created anytime a group of people or organizations decides to directly issue credit to each other for their own goods and services. The easiest way, of course, to join the community credit world is to look for the LETS or the business barter systems or the time banks that already exist in your local community. It's always easiest to join one that already exists. And then you'll also get the experience of what it's like to rediscover direct interdependence in community, which is how we evolved. And it's a capacity that we've let go of, that we've lost while we were so focused on creating this global empire, this single global economic community. We've lost the experience of direct interdependence in local communities. And this is a way of rediscovering what that's like, to become an economic tribe with people you directly know and trust. So you can do that either by joining one that already exists in your local network. Just look for them, Google them, Google LETS or time banks or business barter systems in your local area. Or you can actually create your own if you don't have one. And the experience of creating a community credit facility is now, these technologies have gotten to the point where that experience is comparable to the experience of creating a website. You don't need any technical training. If you want a website, you just go to Snap Pages or WordPress or Squarespace or one of these platforms and you sign up for an account and you start making your design decisions, and within 2 hours you've got a website. Well, nowadays, if you want to create a community credit facility, you just go to Community Forge, which is the one that we used in the biomimicry community, or you could go to CES, that stands for Community Exchange Systems, that's based out of South Africa, and it's got over 800 communities using that software worldwide. Or you could go to, if you're a business, there's one based out of Barbados called Collective Currency, that's recommended by the experts in this field, etc. The German-speaking world tends to use one called Zyklos. But so you choose one of these platforms, go to their website, sign up for free, and then you can immediately start making your design decisions, like what would be your unit of value? That's one of the decisions you get to make. What should be the credit limit for each individual participating? What should be the credit limit for an organization if you want to bring in an organization? Do you want to have an interest rate or the opposite? Do you want to have demurrage or neither? Or do you want to have some sort of tax, or do you want to have some sort of transaction fee? Those are all the design decisions that you can then make, and within a couple of hours you've got a credit facility. So the technologies are no longer the obstacle. Now it's a simple matter of choice, of awareness and choice, awareness that we have the choice between community credit and bank credit, and then choosing to step into them. It's like choosing to buy organic. You can have the options available, but if nobody chooses them, it doesn't make a difference. So we've now got these options available, and the way that we make them work is that we choose them collectively, because money is a collective technology.
Well, I've always thought that the ideal money system would be one in which it was a national community currency system. I mean, it seems to me the problem with trying to integrate all these local community currency systems is, like you say, they've got different terms, different credit terms, et cetera. And there's the problem of getting big loans, although we know that the Vier, for example, in Switzerland makes quite big loans. They funded a spa that we actually went to in Switzerland. They funded half of it, and the other half was in Swiss francs, I guess. But I read that Ecuador has now set up a system where individuals can have a bank account directly with the central bank. And that's what seems to me is what our money system is. Like, it's mutual credit. It's one big mutual credit system, and we don't need the gatekeepers anymore, the ones that allege that they're taking in deposits and lending them out again, and we now know that they aren't. They're actually lending, they're actually creating deposits when they make loans. So we can do that ourselves, or the great computer in the cloud can do that itself. But anyway, I wonder if you have any comments on, like, the larger systems going on, like the Vier, or, you know, how you would overcome these compatibility problems, et cetera.
I'll start with the technical side of compatibility. So right now, I mentioned several different systems that are being used, and so far it hasn't been possible to communicate between them just in terms of the software. You can't open an account that would, an import-export account that would allow you to send credit between these facilities, because they're not yet able to communicate with each other. So now the system designers are working on developing software extensions that would be compatible with all of the major systems being used, and that would allow them to communicate with each other. So those extensions would not change the design elements of the local community, so it wouldn't compromise the sovereignty of the local community over their design elements, but it would let them communicate with each other. And when you talk about the problem that they all have different terms, well, that's not a problem when you talk about an import-export agreement, because the principle of mutual exchange works at every level. So if you, the principle that makes one of these systems work, the only principle that has to be adhered to by all the participants in order to make it function, is the principle of mutual exchange, the idea that you're going to participate in one of these credit facilities in a balanced way. You're going to give and receive equally, just like we want to have a balanced partnership with the earth. We want to give and receive equally from the earth. We want to have a balanced partnership with our families. We want to give and receive equally in our families. It's the same principle extended to a credit facility. And so long as you know that everybody's agreeing to that principle, and what that means concretely is that you're going to start with a balance of zero when you open an account. You're going to start trading. And before you leave the system, if you were to leave it in the future, you would have to bring your balance back down to zero. And that principle then works at the next level. If you have a community credit facility that's composed of community credit facilities, so it's a community of communities, they're participating with each other in the import-export market on the same principle, that they're going to import and export equally from each other. And that's how you guarantee that there will be a balanced exchange. So that's how you go larger, is you just apply the exact same design principles to a community of communities, and then you could do it at the next level up.
You've also mentioned some interesting things you learned at that conference, and just some interesting biomimicry facts that I just think people would be interested to hear.
Well, we were talking about some of the biological metaphors that are useful for reflecting on the design of our money system. And it can be very insightful to understand how the economics of the natural world works. What kind of economics does the natural world have? So if you were to study, for example, a forest is an economy. Every natural system is an economy. There are resources being distributed and exchanged throughout the economy that support the health of the entire system, but also the individuals within it. And so if you were to study the dynamics of those systems, you can come up with some interesting principles that inform our economic ideas. So in a forest, what you see are that the economic establishments of the forest are, you could think of those as being trees. The trees have huge infrastructures. They've already benefited from huge amounts of investment over time. And they have advantageous positioning to fix resources. So the canopy is in the most advantageous position to convert sunlight into resources, what they need, and to fix carbon through photosynthesis. And what you see happening then is that these are the haves. These are the establishment. They are actually sending resources down through the fungal networks underground. All of the plants in the forest are connected through underground fungal networks, networks of fungus and bacteria and nematodes, microorganisms. It's called the common mycorrhizal network. It's under the ground, and some people have also nicknamed it the wood wide web. It's how all the communication and exchange happens among the in the forest. So trees are actually fixing carbon and sending that down through those fungal networks into less advantaged plants, even of other species. And they're getting something in return as well. Those plants might be sending them signals telling them which kinds of herbivores are roaming around so that they'll have time to beef up their defenses by the time the herbivore gets to them. So there's a real cooperation where you see a flow of resources from the top to the bottom, as opposed to the way it works in ours, where the haves get richer and the have-nots get poorer, where it's money is flowing from the poor to the rich. We see it the other way around. Things like carbon that's being fixed by the trees is flowing from the top down. But everybody's supporting each other through this constant exchange underground. So those can be interesting models to look at, just to reflect on compare with our economy.
Mm-hmm. And you had mentioned studies where they've actually traced the carbon that's come through the tree and gone into...
A woman named Suzanne Simard, and she led an excellent body of research around tracing those exchanges. And so they were able to tag carbon molecules that were fixed by the trees and see where they went. And they would see how the system managed to send that carbon molecule through those underground networks to a bush that was in the shadows and didn't have as much sunlight. And then they started doing things like they would plant three trees next to each other and look at how they were exchanging resources. And then they would cover one. They would shade it so it wasn't getting as much sunlight and then see if something changed. And what changed was that the others that weren't covered would help it out. When that one was in the shade, then the other two would send it nutrients. And so, and another thing is that saplings, they realized, only sprout where they can connect into the root system of a mother tree, because the saplings need that support from the mother tree. And when a mother tree is dying, this is the most inspirational evolutionary role I can imagine for the conventional financial system. So when the mother tree is dying, it actually invests even more heavily into the saplings. So it's recognizing that it has fulfilled its evolutionary role, and now the best way it can leave gracefully is to invest itself in the next generation that's coming after it. So if you can imagine our financial system that has fulfilled the role of facilitating our expansionary youthful phase, growth phase, having now completed that role, if investors, of just individuals and organizations and businesses and whoever, who finds themselves embedded within the conventional financial system, which is generally most of us, and has at least some space to play with how they're going to invest their resources. If they were to turn their attention to the community credit facilities and the community credit universe that's growing underneath the canopy of established finance, then that would be choosing to play the mother tree role, which to me is the most inspiring role for conventional finance.
Do you have a website that you'd like to mention?
Well, if you'd like to know more about this topic in particular, we do have a webinar that was created by the BioCredits Working Group of the Biomimicry Global Network. That's available, for example, on my website, which is consciousevolution.ch.
Oh, thank you so much. It's really great to be speaking with you here in California. Thanks, Jamie.
Likewise, thank you for your interest in the biomimicry approach.
I've been speaking with Jamie Brown, a managing partner of Biomimicry Switzerland.
And now, a brief musical interlude with a track off a newly issued CD by the New Economistas, poking some fun at the changing nature of money in our society and how it's obtained.
Great-great-granddad made his cash pan in for gold. Your great-grandma invested. But now we found ways to make money out of air. Hedge funds, derivatives, and credit default swaps. Once we were working class, now we're on top. We brainwash the people into thinking that it's fair for the Federal Reserve to make money out of air. The stock market casino is a bookie's dream come true. You place your bets and get a cut no matter how they do. But if we get in trouble and things get out of hand, we'll call our uncle to bail us out. Thank you, Uncle Sam. Hedge funds, derivatives, and credit default swaps. Once we were middle class, now we're on top. Brainwash the people into thinking that it's fair for the Federal Reserve to make money out of air. If you invest in local, your money grows real slow. But it's in your own hometown with people that you know. We'll shift our wealth back to the earth and grow it naturally. We'll do no more for money's sake, build justice and peace. Hedge funds, derivatives, and credit default swaps. Once we were upper class, now we're on top. We brainwash the people into thinking that it's fair for the Federal Reserve to make money out of air. Hedge funds, derivatives, and credit default swaps. Once we were working class, now we're on top. Brainwash the people into thinking that it's fair for the Federal Reserve to make money out of air.
The New Economists are Gwendolyn Hall-Smith and Michael Taub, and you can find their new release at soundcloud.com/The New Economists. We heard Bernie Sanders open this program with a rather shocking description of how out of balance our financial world is, and how distorted the distribution of economic resources is between the members of our national and global economy. All people are the components of that financial ecosystem, and each must have a proper place to thrive and contribute to the whole. That was the basic message of the discussion earlier between Ellen and Jamie Brown. Distributed well-being, multidimensional interdependency of living components, mutually supported interests that are served by systems that sustain all, with, as Bucky Fuller used to say, no one and no thing left out. So let's return for just a couple of minutes to Bernie's comments from that press conference, where he was talking about legislation to break up the big banks, and to think about his comments in terms of the metrics of the financial sickness that we're living with, the overpowering singular organism of monetary concentration that will, like a cancer in the natural world, devour its host.
While the middle class continues its 40-year decline, we have 45 million people living in poverty and the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country on earth. Half of the American people have less than $10,000 in savings and have no idea as to how they will retire with dignity. The real unemployment rate today is not 5.5%, but it is close to 11%. It seems like almost every day we read about one giant financial institution after another being fined or reaching settlements for their reckless, unfair, and deceptive activities. Can't pick up a paper without reading about one scandal after another. In fact, since 2009, huge financial institutions have paid $176 billion in fines and settlement payments for fraudulent and unscrupulous activities. Bank of America has paid over $57 billion. J.P. Morgan has paid over $31 billion. And Citigroup has paid over $12 billion in fines and settlements. Bank of America has been fined for foreclosure abuses, selling toxic mortgage-backed securities, LIBOR manipulation, and currency rigging, among other things. It should make every American extremely nervous that in this weak regulatory environment, the financial supervisors in our country and around the world are still able to uncover an enormous amount of fraud on Wall Street and other financial institutions to this very day. I fear very much
that the financial system is even more fragile than many people may perceive. This huge issue simply cannot be swept under the rug. It has got to be addressed. During the financial crisis of 2008, the American people were told that they needed to bail out huge financial institutions because they were too big to fail. Yet today, three out of the four largest financial institutions in this country, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo, are 80% larger than they were on September 30th, 2007, a year before the taxpayers of this country bailed them out. So we bailed out the largest financial institutions in this country because they were too big to fail. And today, three out of the four largest are now much, much larger than they were when we bailed them out. Incredibly, during that time, J.P. Morgan Chase has increased its assets by more than $1 trillion, Bank of America by more than $500 billion, and Wells, after Wells Fargo acquired Wachovia, it has more than tripled its size. In other words, if any of these financial institutions were to fail again, the taxpayers of this country would be on the hook for another bailout, perhaps even larger than the last one. We must not allow that to happen. No single financial institution should be so large that its failure would cause catastrophic risk to millions of Americans or to our nation's economic well-being. No single financial institution should have holdings so extensive that its failure would send the world economy into crisis. If an institution is too big to fail, it is too big to exist, and that is the bottom line.
I'm Matt Stannard, and this is the Public Banking Report coming to you the day after the first debate among Democratic Party contenders for the 2016 presidential election. And I'm sorry to say that after watching the event, I was left with the strong impression that although many of these folks make competent leaders, they do not leave me feeling more secure. In particular, I was left contemplating all the candidates' economic proposals. Lots of proposals to regulate the banks, proposals for a $15 minimum wage, free college tuition, the preservation of Social Security, and some promises of a transition to a green economy. Lots of potential there, but the discussion remained fixed on policies that redistribute rather than rebuild, and so continue to depend on doing things the same old way. In my work, I try to identify the legal and policy challenges standing in the way of economic justice in the broad sense of the term, the building of an economy that recognizes our mutual interdependence, that encourages sustainable productivity, that provides people with real security. Security is an important word here. Last night, while I was live tweeting the Democratic debate, I posted some articles about the connections between poverty and gun violence, for example, or crony capitalism and reckless imperialist foreign policy. Connections that even Bernie Sanders wasn't making, and certainly the other candidates weren't making. For me, these are issues of security. People lash out when they're insecure. Nations mistreat their neighbors, fail to welcome refugees. They kill their own people based on appeals to a false kind of security to cover up the real insecurities, personal and governance-oriented, that presently plague the human condition. Material insecurity as a cause and complement to spiritual or emotional insecurity causes violence. Some people think that's controversial, but it's really just good science to say that both individuals and communities react poorly under the unrelenting stress of material insecurity. There's a strong unconscious Calvinist streak in American political discourse, sometimes on the left as well as the right. There was a short discussion about gun violence during last night's debate, and the media sometimes attributes social violence to a culture of entitlement, when it's at least as much a product of a culture of insecurity. Entitlement is something that we should demand collectively for all of us, a share without qualification in the abundance of a well-lived life, walking in balance between gregarious enjoyment of this world and responsible coexistence with it. And some of the people who commit mass violence have just lost their jobs, which is not to say that killing your former coworkers is an appropriate response, but which is to make parallels between doing something like that and committing the kind of terrorism we attribute to Al-Qaeda, or the militaristic nihilism of ISIS, organizations that recruit from among the unemployed and materially alienated. So let me get back to the debate, or more precisely what I wished the candidates would have discussed in the debate. For a while now, I've made this distinction between policies that mainly redistribute and policies that restructure. My sense is that policies that merely redistribute don't alleviate insecurity because they don't alter the scarcity paradigm. That doesn't mean that some of those policies aren't still good ideas. Last night, Bernie Sanders again proposed to pay for higher education with a financial transaction tax. The financial transaction tax is a terribly good idea. There's almost no downside to it whatsoever. It would represent such a tiny individual collection from such a broad swath of the economy that many people would hardly notice it, except in the case of massive financial transactions, the kind that need to be taxed. So that was a good idea, Bernie, and not even just because it could pay for education. But a financial transaction tax wouldn't bring the kind of permanent security of public banks. Public banks don't redistribute money. They don't tax and spend. They change the way we spend, particularly the way we invest, and in doing so, have the potential to actually rein in taxation. Public banking is a policy that restructures rather than redistributes. Structures like public banks hardwire accountability and cooperation into our financial system. Other policies have similar potential. They don't depend on the generosity of the elites, but rather maximize our own collective generosity and resourcefulness. Bernie Sanders, by the way, knows exactly what public banks are. He's introduced limited versions of them as a legislator, information sadly missing from his presidential campaign materials, from his individual stump speeches, and from last night's debate. Although I knew I wouldn't hear those kind of proposals, those are the ones I wish I would hear. There are parties who articulate such policies, but those parties have been marginalized from national politics by the same corporate interests who, to keep my theme going, prefer the scarcity and occasional redistribution model over the development of a new, sustainably abundant economy. Their own insecurity, the thought of being irrelevant in a world where communities have bypassed Wall Street, informs their preference for scarcity politics. After all, why would we need them if we knew what to do with our money? But we do know what we can do, and that's why, after watching the debates, I got back to thinking about the work we're doing at the Public Banking Institute, work which we'd love those national candidates to contemplate and discuss. And we're nevertheless busy in the meantime on the ground in over 30 states. For now, at least, overcoming insecurity and building a new economy are parts of a mosaic of local politics, not visible on the stage in Nevada last night, not yet on the radar of corporate two-party politics. I'm happy to keep doing what I'm doing. The conversation is changing in all the right places, in some far more interesting debates than the one on TV last night.
New Hampshire State Representative Valerie Fraser has sponsored a bill in the state's House of Representatives to establish a state bank, a publicly owned bank, and is making solid progress with that initiative. It's not the first time that such a bill has been introduced to that state house, but it's gotten a lot more traction this time around thanks to her efforts and the team that she's aligned around supporting its passage. We wanted to find out what motivated her interest in creating a public bank, especially after three previous unsuccessful attempts by other legislators.
New Hampshire spends, at least last year and over the last 10 years, annually spends about $77 million in interest only, and in the last 10 years has spent over $500 million in just in interest. That's a tremendous amount of money that could be kept here in the state to be used like a utility for the people, using it to help the people. We could eventually lower taxes, property taxes. And I think that would be a tremendous boost to everyone's bottom line if they don't have to pay really high property taxes. and it can benefit possibly the New Hampshire college students who pay the highest rate of the country. And it could help the pension fund because they're concerned about that. There's just an issue out today that what they thought they received really wasn't as high as they thought. They thought it was 3.5% interest, but it turned out because the market was dropping that actually was more like 1.5%.
Now, you might want to make a note that when she said that the state's pension fund reported a 1.5% return on investment, that these funds are frequently pegged to perform at almost 8%. Meaning that the retirement dollars set aside for retiring state workers is lagging far behind projections. We see that all over the country, that the funds for people's retirement are reflecting the weak economy, as well as the fact that these pension funds are often targets for easy borrowing by governments who need cash. Having a public bank in the investment portfolio of pension funds appears to be one way that these pension funds can perform more on par. New Hampshire is a proudly conservative state, just like North Dakota. So we had to ask.
And what kind of response are you getting from your colleagues? Are they looking at you askance because this sounds like something that might be, socialist or something?
Yeah, sometimes if they don't understand it, it does sound. When any time you say this is going to help the people, they tend to think it's socialist. But really, it is a form of socialism in a way, but it's helping everyone, and it's helping the state, and we're keeping our money that all of us, whether we're Republican or Democrat or independent or whatever we are, we work hard for our money, and this is a way of keeping our wealth here rather than giving it away through interest. If we can create our own money through loans, which is how a debt system works, then we can keep the money here.
New Hampshire is filled with charming small towns and a bucolic setting. Local economies that depend on access to affordable credit to prosper. But affordable credit and prosperity have been elusive in recent years. How are they taking to the idea of having a supportive state public bank?
For some, it's a difficult process because, like a lot of us, when you first start thinking about public bank, it just kind of doesn't make sense because it's different than what we know as business as usual. But it seems to be well received after maybe 20, 25, 30 minutes of questioning, and they finally kind of begin to grasp, and you can kind of see the bright light come on over their head that finally kind of understand it. And then they're all very excited about it.
State Representative Valerie Fraser has begun an organization called Banking on New Hampshire, and they'll be holding a public introduction to the topic at a conference scheduled for the first weekend in December, December 4th and 5th, in Manchester, New Hampshire, at the Radisson. It's open to the public, and it's called Where's the Money? You can find out more about this initiative that's underway and growing in New Hampshire at bankingonnewhampshire.org. The conference is